loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we break down the recent allegations from Facebook that there has been an ongoing political influence campaign that has resulted in Facebook shutting down 32 pages. The New York Times, in its headline today, says Facebook busts a shadowy plot to jolt elections, signs of Russian hand. We're going to talk about it with Max Blumenthal, best-selling author and journalist. And then we continue our regular segment every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, and we talk to Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear .org about nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, yesterday was day one in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, who has been charged with 18 felonies related to financial crimes. The Washington Post said that the Justice Department prosecutor was using a scorched earth policy, making bold, unproven assertions and telling jurors that Manafort's profligate spending should be held against him. Meanwhile, Special Counsel Mueller has sent three cases to federal prosecutors, including Democrats Tony Podesta and Greg Craig, who served as counsel to President Obama. Next, activists around the world are deeply concerned that Julian Assange could be evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy in London soon. Recent comments from Ecuador's new president, Lenin Moreno, suggest that a deal with British authorities is in the works. Then, the Trump administration moved today to promote short-term junk insurance plans, further undermining the Affordable Care Act. Meanwhile, the debate over single-payer health care has heated up after a controversial new study was released by the Mercatus Center, funded by the billionaire Koch brothers. And then, the Trump administration is considering a second sharp reduction in the number of refugees who can be settled in the United States, further scaling back a program that is meant to protect the world's most vulnerable people. And this time, there isn't any notable opposition inside the White House. And finally, a far-right Brazilian presidential candidate, Jair Bolsonaro, said yesterday that his country should not feel guilty about its past as the world's most prolific slave importer, adding that Brazil, quote, owes no debt, unquote, to its black citizens. The 63-year-old congressman added that, if elected, he would repeal laws implemented during the presidency of Dilma Rousseff that are aimed at reducing inequality in Brazil. And in other headlines, the Senate passed three of 12 spending bills today required to avert a government shutdown. The bills, which passed 92-6, fund government agencies, including the Departments of Agriculture, Transportation, Treasury, Housing and Urban Development, and the Interior. Recent comments by President Trump have raised concerns about a government shutdown in the fall just ahead of the midterm election. The Federal Reserve is leaving interest rates unchanged, as it announced today, noting that the economy is still strong despite the lack of a rate increase. The Fed currently expects two more rate increases this year. Activists started a hunger strike in front of Brazil's Supreme Court to petition for the freedom of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, still a popular leader, while incarcerated. This comes after 60,000 people gathered last week in downtown Rio for the Free Lula Festival. Trump administration spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders announced today that the U.S. was placing sanctions on top Turkish government officials over the detention of American pastor Andrew Craig Brunson. Both the Minister of Justice and the Interior Minister are being targeted. Despite historically close ties, U.S.-Turkish relations have been deteriorating for several years. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the latest with Facebook. Facebook said it shut down 32 fake pages and accounts yesterday that were part of a, quote, coordinated, inauthentic campaign, close quote, to spread politically divisive material ahead of the U.S. midterm elections in November. The pages, according to Facebook, had more than 290,000 followers. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, yes, the same person who's $16 billion poorer in one day from what happened last week, said that the company has not yet identified who was behind the operation. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He's also a filmmaker. He made with Dan Cohen the new film Killing Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max Blumenthal, welcome back.
Great to be back to discuss this pressing threat to our shining democracy.
Are your knees trembling right now? Do you feel it? Do you feel the danger?
I feel existential threats. I'm afraid. We are being attacked, Brian. We're under attack.
And that's not hyperbole, everybody. That's real, because I'm looking at the New York Times today. The headline is Facebook busts a shadowy plot to jolt elections. Then subhead, signs of Russian hand, subhead, 32 pages and accounts are caught pushing divisive issues. Anyway, let's try to help the audience understand what this shadowy plot to jolt the elections is all about. What did Facebook find?
Well, it looks like Facebook found a few accounts that resemble faintly the Internet Research Agency accounts, which emanated from a troll farm in St. Petersburg. What they found this time are a number of accounts that most of the accounts have between 0 and 7 followers, and most of this material appeared after the 2016 election. And I can't imagine it producing a jolt, but I can walk you through what the Atlantic Council's DFRL lab, or the so-called digital Sherlocks, who are connected to the influence operation known as Bellingcat, funded by the National Endowment for Democracy and NATO, have turned up. And they turned this up 24 hours before Facebook took the post down. So basically, it doesn't appear that the Atlantic Council's digital Sherlocks did any Sherlocking of their own. They basically got this info from Facebook, and Facebook used them to market their findings and to hype up the non-attribution, connecting it to Russia. The report was authored by Ben Nimmo, who's an Atlantic Council fellow who's their bot hunter. He's the resident bot hunter who misidentified the famous Ukrainian concert pianist Valisitsa and a British pensioner who goes by Ian456789 on Twitter as Russian bots, who are actually real people. So this is a really brilliant digital Sherlock. And he found that these accounts sought to exacerbate divisions and set Americans against one another. He couldn't connect them to Russia, but he found that they had the same behavioral patterns as other Russian troll farm accounts. One of the only high performing accounts, and it wasn't very high performing, was called Resistors. And it's a feminist anti-fascist page, which was created months after the 2016 election. There was only really one well-performing post on this page, which is said to be designed to jolt our elections and set Americans against each other. And it was promoting a product created in South Africa to prevent rape called Rapex, which is a vaginal tube that impales men's violating penises on its barbs. This clearly is a Russian plot to prevent rape and thereby destroy our democracy and undermine our elections. There's also posts on this account, Resistors, protesting Trump separating children from their parents and also protesting a neo-Nazi march. So again, they're clearly setting Americans against each other by promoting protests against children in cages and Nazis rampaging through American cities. Now, how did Ben Nimmo know that this post was Russian? Because it had bad grammar in some of its postings. So, you know, maybe it was Russian, but there's nothing more sinister than the Russian account, or the alleged Russian account, Ancestral Wisdom, which Facebook has taken down and which the Atlantic Council has said was designed to exacerbate divisions in our society. What was Ancestral Wisdom dedicated to? According to the Atlantic Council, Black pride and the beauty of African women. Definitely a Russian plot to destroy America, to exacerbate, you know.
Max Blumenthal is our guest. And Max, you know, it's interesting and important, I think, for the audience to also understand, and I think this is an emerging trend, that while this is obviously, as you are dripping with ridicule and sarcasm, which you should be.
No, fear, Brian, fear.
Fear. I thought it was ridicule and sarcasm, but it's actually fear. This is an attack on the left. It's emerging as a pattern. It's Black Lives Matter. It's organizations that are protesting against the Nazis who are coming to celebrate the 1 year anniversary of their murder, their terrorist murder of Heather Heyer. We see a trend where anybody who's advocating for what are now called socially divisive issues, meaning combating the trend of racism or misogyny or xenophobia or perpetual endless war, that somehow becomes sinister. And it is a throwback to the old Cold War, the first Cold War, where Martin Luther King's critics, which would be everybody in the American state apparatus, especially the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, was always making the argument that the civil rights movement was nothing other than a stooge for Soviet communism, and that Martin Luther King was manipulated by or being used by outside agitators, as were all other African-American activists who were fighting against racism and apartheid in America. It has the same sort of overtone, the same thing with the attack on Jill Stein, where these Democrats and Republicans, the two-headed monster of the current political elites, going after a third party, an independent progressive party, all again under the banner of stopping Russia's march to meddle in our democracy.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this Atlantic Council material reads like FBI propaganda. There's another page that was taken down called Warriors of Aslan. And according to the Atlantic Council, this website was pushing what they call the Latin American community towards armed resistance against what they call the white community. And so I looked for evidence of this, and they produced some memes on this page that show indigenous Native American warriors. They just simply depict them. And so this is interpreted as trying to start an armed anti-white rebellion by Latinos in the United States. Basically, this whole analysis produced by the bot hunter Ben Nimmo of the NATO-funded Atlantic Council, who's been hired by Facebook to market their supposed digital security measures against Russia, says a lot more about NATO and the Atlantic Council than it does about Russia, because they've interpreted pretty much everything from the beauty of African women to pictures of Native warriors to the take a knee protests against police brutality, which took place in the NFL, as attempts to exacerbate division in American society. And basically what the point they're making is that these racial justice protests and the mere celebration of Black women's beauty is a threat to American democracy. And then it's all marketed under the guise of protecting our elections. This is part of the DFRL Labs election watch. And so, you know, there's so many layers here of deeply embedded conservatism and national security state hysteria. And it's completely overhyped. As I mentioned, the Ancestral Wisdom account had 7 followers. I mean, why does this even deserve our attention? The Warriors of Aslan had 0 followers. And then there's Mindful Beings, which is the other site that they took down, which is an apolitical, holistic living site that featured memes warning about the overuse of digital social media, which really just shows how ridiculous the whole thing is. I mean, is this Putin's 97-degree chess to get us to stop using social media so he can divide us on social media? I mean, none of this even makes any sense, but the New York Times is taking it seriously. So I think the real threat to our democracy emanates from the Atlantic Council and the New York Times hyping this up. And of course, Facebook was pushed into this by Congress earlier last year.
Yeah, because at first they weren't going along.
Yeah, they said, this is absurd. You know, why do you want to focus on this when, you know, there's so many other fake pages and influence operations on Facebook?
The Internet Research Agency, the St. Petersburg trolling firm, according to the government Russiagate probe, spent about $80,000 on 2,500 ads, 56% of which were put up after the election, after the November 2016 election. In contrast, the Trump administration spent $90 million on Facebook ads. I mean, it was a very complicated, complex, sophisticated, and I think effective Facebook ad. The use of Facebook for advertising purposes. But now we have, again, $90 million spent by the Trump campaign. And I think the Clinton campaign, which had a less sophisticated Facebook and social media campaign, we can get into that perhaps. But they also spent tens of millions of dollars. This was $80,000 from a St. Petersburg trolling firm. 56% of the ads were after the election. Very, very few of the ads were seen by anyone. And most of the ads, 90% of them, didn't reference any political candidate. And yet somehow this became like a thing that influenced or jolted our democracy. Max Blumenthal, when you look at what's actually happening, who's now censoring or taking down Facebook posts? And I want to say it's not only the post, the Facebook page against the Nazi, pro-Nazi rally that's scheduled for August 12th here in Washington, D.C. There were a lot of pro-Palestinian and Palestinian rights Facebook pages that have been taken down by Facebook. But you have Facebook, a privately owned corporation led by a billionaire, super billionaire. You have Atlantic Council, which is a neocon think tank. And you have the FBI all working in together to suppress what they deem to be a shadowy plot, unexplained, and somehow suggesting it's Russia, although there's no evidence here whatsoever. It is kind of a danger to what people might think about the free expression of ideas.
Well, this is the real influence operation taking place, and it's being weaponized by these former intelligence officials who ran influence operations in other countries, who drummed up color revolutions, and who are now contributors to the major cable news networks. John Brennan, Michael Hayden, James Clapper. These are figures who oversaw influence operations throughout their entire career. They understand information warfare as well as any intelligence professional, and they are now directing content through cable news. And a lot of this is also taking place on Facebook. I was just in Nicaragua investigating the coup that's just been defeated there. It was a U.S.-backed coup. It took very violent form for about 55 days, and it began on April 18th over fake news that a student at a public university in Nicaragua had been killed by Nicaraguan national police. This fake news was pumped out, and I learned about this while I was there from many people who were trying to unpack how this all unfolded. The fake death was pumped out through messages recorded in studios, claiming to be students inside the university being burned alive. This just completely fake messaging sent out to millions of young Nicaraguans on WhatsApp. It was followed by a flood of sponsored content on Facebook, promoting a combination of fake news and the opposition's narrative on sites that had previously not existed before. People were receiving direct messages on Twitter and on Facebook from people they hadn't met before, and basically whipped the whole country into a frenzy, which actually did lead to violence or contributed to violence. And this is not to discount any legitimate grievances that people might have had against the government. But this was, I mean, you're really able, I'm able to witness an influence operation taking a small country into the throes of chaos. And it took place on Facebook. And so when you really want to look at real influence operations, you have to go to the countries where people are targeted. I think we're being targeted by one in the form of Russiagate, and all of this hyper-focused attention onto these troll pages, which have seven followers, is part of the influence operation because it's deflecting from the reality of how we're actually being manipulated. But again, the figures behind it and the people who are marketing it have experiences in other countries driving color revolutions and soft coups. And these tactics were previously tested in the laboratories of Eastern Europe, Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, and they've come back home.
We're speaking with Max Blumenthal about what the New York Times calls the shadowy plot to jolt elections by 32 pages and accounts of what Facebook says are false Facebook pages. You know, I want to pick up on the theme that you just, or the point that you just made, Max, because I think it's so, so important for people to understand. I mean, perhaps Russia is interfering or trying to interfere in other governments' elections. Perhaps. We don't know. If there's evidence, we'll find out. But so far, even with the Manafort trial, there's no even mention of Russia, and you would think that would be the key moment for it.
They're not allowed to mention Russia in the Manafort trial. I mean,
the prosecutors promised the judge the word Russia won't come up in the Manafort trial.
I mean, or the word oligarch. It's banned.
Well, There goes that.
That's for the trial that's taking place in the media, not actually in the courtroom. But, you know, here I'm looking at The Guardian. U.S. secretly created, this is 2014, U.S. secretly created, quote, Cuban Twitter, close quote, to stir unrest and undermine the government. USAID, which is really just, you know, a partner with the CIA, started Zunio, a social network built on text in hopes it could organize, quote, smart mobs to trigger a Cuban spring, meaning a Cuban counter-revolution. The U.S. government set this entire social media operation up designed to and targeting Cuban youth. Cuban youth who wanted to use and started to use the platform didn't know that it was a CIA thing, but the CIA set it up not so that Cuban youth could talk to each other, but that eventually the Cuban youth would rise up against the Cuban government. I mean, is that, are we talking about like severe meddling? Can you imagine if Russia created a false social platform that millions of American youth were on, and it was completely 100% a clandestine operation by the Russian government?
Well, it's like the old anti-drug ad where the dad finds his son's stash and he says, "Where did you learn this from?" And the kid says, "I learned it from watching you, Dad."
I remember that.
If Russia's doing it, they learned it from the best, and it's far more elegant than the mechanisms we've put in play in other countries. You know, I'm not totally denying that Russia has been involved. I'd like to see some concrete evidence, however. The Zunzaneo fake Twitter model was not effective, but what they aimed to do was to just get young people out in flash mobs and then start kind of creating chaos and then testing you know, Cuba's national security apparatus and see how it functioned. It did work in Nicaragua. And I don't know if USAID was behind it, although they've just announced a $1.5 million investment in Nicaraguan opposition and opposition media, which supplements the $5 million they've donated over the past 3 years. But what would happen in Nicaragua in April when the coup began? And it started out with protests over the social security system, which actually Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas were trying to offset austerity measures by the IMF by raising taxes on big business owners. And they wound up getting protested for austerity, not the IMF. And then those social security protests ballooned into a full-scale violent coup. But what would happen in towns across Nicaragua, and people from around the country would show me these accounts, was that months before the coup, publications would be set up that were focused on chisme and escándalo, gossip and scandal. And it was basically drawing in followers and drawing in likes, the way that these troll accounts function on Facebook. And then as soon as the coup began, overnight, they began pumping the opposition's propaganda along with fake news about deaths and massacres and genocide and just whipping up the country. And it was a very effective mechanism. Again, I don't know if USAID is behind this, but it really fits the Zunzaneo model that was put into play years ago in Cuba.
Yeah, and Zunzaneo had 40,000 Cuban, mostly young people, at its peak.
Yeah, in a small country, that's a lot.
I mean, again, this was the CIA setting up a Twitter account so that they could have a, quote, Cuban spring.
And this isn't the only example. I'm not going to go into detail, but this is not unique to Cuba. This happens elsewhere as well.
Yeah, maybe you have some stories. I don't know.
John doesn't want to go back to prison.
No,
I think that's what you
prefer not.
I prefer not. And for our audience, John Kiriakou went to prison as a CIA officer because he exposed the CIA torture program. But of course, you know, I'm looking at different articles. I mean, there's been so many instances where the U.S. government has interfered since the end of World War II, for instance, in other countries'
elections.
Yeah,
it's supposed to be like 85 or 83 different elections, something like that.
And then when the U.S. doesn't like the election outcome, let's say they failed, say in Iran 1953 or Guatemala in 1954 or the Congo in 1960 or Allende with Chile in 1973, you just have the CIA carry out bloody coup d'etats and kill thousands of people because they didn't vote the right way. Or, Max, what happened in Gaza? I mean, like when the Palestinians had an election and they elected the wrong party.
Yeah, actually, in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, there was a period when he was considering retirement and Hillary Clinton ordered him to stay in office indefinitely. So this is the kind of treatment Palestinians have received. The U.S. also orchestrated a coup against the Gaza Strip. using the Palestinian Authority to attempt to override their election result. They actually, Hamas actually won a majority in Palestinian national elections in the West Bank. And so it was there that Israel began kidnapping the legislators who won with U.S. assent as the invasion of Gaza, which actually failed, took place. So that's just another, that's kind of the hard power version of interference. But the soft power is taking place all over the globe. And then, you know, I've written about this. I think the wave of the future is really these private intelligence firms like Archimedes and Cambridge Analytica, SEL Group. We've just found out that the SEL Group, which is the parent company of Cambridge Analytica, played a key role in the defeat of the Kirchners in Argentina, which has seen the rise of right-wing rule and the layoff of tens of thousands of public workers. So, this is a global phenomenon, and it's generally being used against left-wing and progressive social movements.
And in 1996, the United States and the U.S. government actually, or parts of it, and certainly the media bragged about it, directly intervened in Russia because their guy, Boris Yeltsin, was getting like about 5% of the vote in the 1996 elections. The Communist Party was going to win. Huge amounts of American money and American political operatives were flown into Russia, and they micromanaged the campaign. There was that famous cover from Time magazine, July 15th, 1996. It's a picture of Boris Yeltsin with little American flags, and the headline is "Exclusive Yanks to the Rescue." I mean, this is the norm.
Yeah, there's actually a great film that, you know, anyone listening to this should watch. It's a Hollywood comedy about how the 96 election was stolen by the U.S. in favor of Boris Yeltsin, called Spinning Boris, starring Jeff Goldblum. He's playing this kind of mid-level California consultant who also worked on the California recall, named George Gordon. Basically, Pete Wilson, who is a moderate Republican governor of California, 3 of his staffers were sent out to Moscow, put in a hotel where they were sequestered and basically had no contact with anything, and told to conceive a winning campaign for this failing candidate, Boris Yeltsin, who was stripping the state's assets, and basically looting the former assets of the Soviet Union, handing them over to a collection of oligarchs. The oligarchs paid for these consultants to come over there, along with the Russian mafia. This is all depicted in this film. And they conceived a campaign using, you know, kind of American Reaganite politics to humanize Boris Yeltsin, make him a friendly figure who dances and smiles and kisses babies, something Yeltsin was completely unfamiliar with. And then, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the regime change arm of the U.S., infected Russian media with a narrative about how dangerous the communist candidate would be towards Russia's future. Yeltsin ultimately won and continued destroying Russia's economy, producing something like 3 to 5 million excess deaths. All the people who were relying on the benefits and pensions that they had in the Soviet Union just simply died off. And the inevitable result was Putin. So the U.S. has produced enormous amounts of instability and unintended consequences around the world because of its destabilization attempts. I just recently went to, and I'll be releasing video of this, a gathering of the National Endowment for Democracy. And this is a wing of the U.S. government that's now working against Trump's efforts for peace on the Korean Peninsula. So they're actually undermining any U.S. attempts at diplomacy in the name of regime change. It's destabilizing the political system from within.
All right, that was Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist. He's a best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He's also a filmmaker. His most recent film is Killing Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States with Kevin Camp. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and find out about the group and get involved with the group, which is the most important thing, at beyondnuclear.org. And we're also joined, as we are every Wednesday, in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks.
Kevin, you, before this segment begins every week, send us a list of some of the big stories. The first one that I'm looking at is reactors are closing. Okay, so that sounds like a good thing from the point of view of Beyond Nuclear.
It is really good news. We just got news that Duane Arnold in Iowa has announced a closure date next year, I believe. And what that means is once the irradiated nuclear fuel comes out of the atomic reactor core and is put into the wet storage pool for radioactive decay and cooling down, you can't have a meltdown anymore. That's the good news. The bad news is that the high-level radioactive waste has moved to the pool. The danger has moved to the pool, which is a very dangerous place. There's still the dry cast storage outdoors of high-level radioactive waste. There's still the radioactive contamination of the buildings and the landscape at the nuclear power plant. And all those risks go forward into the future.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like? Like, what does the wet storage look like? What does the dry storage look like? What are the risks associated? Can you go a little bit more into that?
The wet storage pools are inside warehouse-type buildings, but they're not inside radiological containment structures. And Fukushima Daiichi is another, you know, lesson, a cautionary tale. So the 160,000 nuclear evacuees were due to reactor core meltdowns that then breached containment structures around the reactors. And that danger of that radioactivity forced 160,000 people to flee for their lives and their health. And they can't go back home. But one of the pools at Fukushima Daiichi, those were three reactors that melted down and released their contents to the environment, unprecedented, multiple meltdowns like that. One of the pools at Fukushima Daiichi, unit number four, nearly caught fire. And the Japanese prime minister who served at the time, Naoto Kan, publicly revealed a year later after the catastrophe began that he had a secret contingency plan in the works that if the pool went up in flames, they would evacuate as many as 50 million people from northeastern Japan to get away from the radioactivity releases. We have worse risks in our pools in the United States. We have our pools here packed more to the gills with high-level radioactive waste than did the Japanese. So, for example, there's been a scientific study done, published in Science a couple years ago now, that showed that if the Peach Bottom atomic reactors in Pennsylvania, just over the Maryland line, not too far from here in Washington, D.C., if one of those pools were to catch fire, in July weather conditions, they did the meteorological computer runs. Right off D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York, and maybe Boston. Write those cities off because now they would be so radioactively contaminated that nobody could live there. I mean, how many trillions of dollars? About $2 trillion at least in property damage. More than that, actually, in New York alone.
And displacement out the wazoo.
What does it mean, write those cities off? Those are the major northeast cities of the United States.
Well, we've talked about that on a previous show, that on the last day of the Obama administration, Gina McCarthy at the Environmental Protection Agency did a major regulatory rollback on EPA radioactivity regulations that in an emergency, like I've just described, you know, we're going to have an interim period where, well, maybe the laws and the regulations don't apply to how bad the radioactivity levels are in the environment. People can keep on living there, can keep on drinking that water. Of course, the consequence of that is people are going to get sick and die in very large numbers. So what it means to write those cities off is they are not safe to live in anymore. And if you want to do the cleanup radiologically, it's going to cost you many billions or tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars to clean up those urban messes, radioactively speaking, and where's that money going to come from?
I want to pull back a little bit and make it really clear for our listeners what this looks like, because when you hear about a pool catching on fire, these are, you know, it doesn't make a ton of logical sense until you really realize what's in those pools. So this is, these are internal structures in the reactors, and they are for radioactive waste. There are both wet structures and dry structures to hold radioactive waste. And you're saying that in the U.S. we are, you know, packing these pools much more fully with radioactive waste than Japan did when we look at the pool that did or almost caught fire in Fukushima. That pool was actually packed less full than they are here in the U.S., so they're even more of a danger.
Yeah, the wet pools are giant in size. They're 40 feet deep because the irradiated nuclear fuel, which are bundles of fuel rods about as big around as your little finger, but a couple hundred in a fuel assembly. They're these the assemblies are these rectangular-shaped columns about 12 or 14 feet long. They get transferred from the reactor core over to the pool when they're no longer useful for electricity generation. They've been depleted of their enriched uranium, and they're not efficient anymore, but they're highly radioactive, and they're thermally very hot. They have to cool and decay radioactively in the storage pool for at least 5 years. These days, more like 10, because they use high burn-up fuel, it's called, and it's even more thermally hot and radioactive. So 10 years of pool storage in this warehouse-type building.
So because they burn so much hotter, there's just that many more years they need to cool down.
Yeah, they actually enrich the high burn-up fuel to a higher level of uranium-235, and that means there's more fission products after irradiation. So it's going to be more radioactive, and consequently, it's more thermally hot for a longer period of time. And so that's 10 years of pool storage, if not longer, to be safe. And then when the pools are full, which they are in the United States, they're full. They can't put any more waste in there. In fact, they are packed five times what they should be by original design. They've retrofitted them, and they've packed them to the gills. Incredibly enough, the pools are so densely packed that it's almost the same density as an operating reactor core. And they have to take extraordinary measures to prevent nuclear chain reactions between the irradiated nuclear fuel assemblies. They have to put chemicals in the water, boric acid, to absorb neutrons. They have to put metal sleeves that are impregnated with boron to absorb neutrons. A lot of things can go wrong. They have degradation of these metal sleeves going on. Sometimes the chemistry isn't right in the water. So they're risking inadvertent nuclear chain reactions in the storage pool, which has no reactor pressure vessel around it, has no robust reactor containment around it. Those are the kind of risks they're willing to take. The overflow parking at nuclear power plants, because the pools are full now, is called dry cask storage, literally out in the parking lot, essentially. And that's growing by leaps and bounds. There's a couple thousand or more of these dry casks. They're 20-foot tall cylinders of concrete and steel at the reactor sites. And Holtec International, that we've talked a lot about on this show, they specialize in that. Their containers, their dry cask storage containers, are used at 33-plus atomic reactor sites in the United States.
Which is about a third.
About a third. They're ever expanding. And a major expansion that just happened yesterday, they just announced, the day that our public comments on environmental scoping for the New Mexico Centralized Interim Storage Facility were due, and we met that deadline in a big way, Holtec announces in a press release that they are taking over decommissioning and high-level radioactive waste management at Palisades in Michigan, at Pilgrim in Massachusetts, and also at Oyster Creek in New Jersey. So now Holtec and its partner from Canada called SNC-Lavalin are going to be major players in the decommissioning marketplace. This is brand new news. And we know a lot about Holtec and its corporate corruption. And it's really scary that not only are they going to be major players, as they already are, in high-level radioactive waste storage and transport and even disposal, but now they're going to get into the decommissioning marketplace. And the dangers are that they'll leave a lot of contamination behind and people will get sick and die in these places.
Because these are, in some ways, technical terms. They don't sound technical. Decommissioning, I don't know if it's technical or not, but let's just go through it again, what it actually means, again, for our lay audience, which would be all of us.
Well, decommissioning is the dismantlement of radioactive facilities at nuclear power plants and dealing with that waste. It is considered low-level radioactive waste because if it's not a fuel rod, a fuel assembly, it's considered low-level, no matter how highly radioactive it is. That's how absurd our regulations are. There's a category of low-level waste called greater than Class C. You've got Class A, the lowest level radioactivity. Class B, higher. Class C, higher than that. Greater than Class C, radiologically equivalent to irradiated nuclear fuel, but considered low-level radioactive waste. And we're learning more and more about how fast and loose government agencies are playing with this highly radioactive waste category called greater than Class C. So decommissioning involves all of those categories. And then a separate issue is high-level radioactive waste management, the irradiated nuclear fuel. And what Holtec has essentially just done is said, we're not just dealing with high-level radioactive waste anymore, the irradiated nuclear fuel. We are now very much going to be involved in this low-level radioactive waste world. And you have to wonder, you know, where that's all going to go. We know where the low-level radioactive waste dumps are. They're all leaking in this country. And one real trick move they try to play is they try to define the lowest category away and say, oh, even though it's radioactive, it's below regulatory concern. Why can't we just dump it in a local garbage dump? They save a lot of money. They're already doing that.
Wow, really?
Yep. One example is Big Rock Point in northern Michigan, which is a part of this Holtec takeover of Palisades, their sister plants. And Big Rock's been shut down since 1996. Some of that waste stream went to a local landfill in Waters, Michigan, and is going to leak over time. These are oftentimes unlined garbage dumps for municipal and household trash. So certain radioactive wastes were declared below regulatory concern and dumped there. And then you've got a Class A national dump in Utah called Energy Solutions. It used to be called EnviroCare. And you've got higher-level, low-level radioactive waste dumps in places like South Carolina, Barnwell. That's leaking massively. You've got a growing one at Waste Control Specialists in Texas, which is national in scope. And WCS, just like Holtec, those two places are 40 miles apart across the Texas-New Mexico border. Also want to get into high-level radioactive waste at this point.
That's Kevin Kemps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Every Wednesday here at Loud and Clear, we talk with Kevin Kemp about the big issues of nuclear energy, nuclear waste, nuclear weapons, and the future of nuclear technology. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel, who is a producer of this show, Loud and Clear, and also a Sputnik News analyst.
So, Kevin, there are a lot of waste issues. There's a lot of leakages we've talked about. There's a lot of human error that goes into these dry cask storages and a lot of overflow on these wet pools for storage. But there's a lot of money in decommissioning former nuclear reactors. Isn't that right?
That's what it's all about. That's what drives Holtec is the money they make. There's another competitor, which involves Waste Control Specialists, and they call that consortium North Star. It's a blasphemous name because their North Star is radioactive greed. That's what they're about. And, you know, if they make a mess in West Texas or if they make a mess in southeastern New Mexico or if they leave a lot of contamination behind at the sites, what that means is they're making more profits because they're just pocketing the money. These nuclear decommissioning trust funds at nuclear power plants, which are ratepayer funded, people are paying into those on their electricity bills, are woefully inadequate for the job at hand. And then the companies, as I mentioned, are taking shortcuts, cutting corners to save money and boost profits. So they're just trying to stick that money in their pocket. And at Palisades in Michigan, when the reactor sold from the previous owner, Consumers Energy, to Entergy in the year 2007, incredibly, the Michigan Public Service Commission served the public up for dinner and allowed these companies to raid the decommissioning trust fund and simply put $200 million in their own pockets, pure profits for no good reason, a sweetener for the sale. And another $100 million was kicked back to the ratepayers as some kind of hush money, like a justification. Well, the ratepayers are going to either have to pay that money back, all $316 million that was raided and looted, or else the cleanup isn't going to happen. And so here we go. Palisades is now saying, okay, we're going to shut down in 2022. Holtec and SNC-Lavalin from Canada are going to do the decommissioning work. There's over $400 million now in the Palisades Decommissioning Trust Fund. It should be over $700 million. So those companies are going to try to pocket that money. And how deep are they going to clean up? Are they going to clean up down inches or feet? We know the contamination extends tens of feet, if not hundreds of feet down into the groundwater, which an adjacent community uses as drinking water. So the risks are very real. Those risks will continue for a long time.
If these companies are making so much money on decommissioning these reactors, I mean, there is clearly plenty of money to do this cleanup and to do this waste management in a way that's actually safe, that's clean, that's okay for the residents around them.
That would require having a rational system.
under capitalism, it doesn't make any sense.
This element of capitalism is really interesting because it's a kind of organized crime. It's an organized crime. Let's say it's organized crime. I mean, and it's highly organized, and it's also criminal, not only because of the dangers it poses, not only criminal because it's really looting. It's the looting of consumers who don't have options. They have to, you can't say, oh, I don't agree with this part of my bill, and I'm not going to pay that part of my bill, because they'll cut you off. So they have a, you know, they have you by the throat. And then it's organized crime because the politicians are just like the bagmen for the nuclear industry.
And it's also poisoning of the residents.
Kevin Camps, is it organized crime?
There ought to be a law. These are extraordinary crimes, actually, against the planet, against public health, against the environment, against future generations, except the laws and the regulations seem to allow it. And that's what's so incredible. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, regarding decommissioning, it's a regulation-free zone. And then check this out. The Zion Nuclear Power Plant, 30 miles north of Chicago, the biggest nuclear decommissioning in U.S. history, two full-size reactors of 1,000 megawatts electric each, $1 billion decommissioning trust fund, and the company from Utah called Energy Solutions in charge of it. There is no independent financial auditing or accounting going on. $1 billion. And again, the question is, how deep is the cleanup going? And how deep does the contamination go? And that's a lot of money that could just be put into a pocket out in Utah, in Salt Lake City. And incredibly, that company, Energy Solutions, it used to be called EnviroCare, very Orwellian, was founded on a bribery extortion crime, a literal crime. The jury was asked, was it bribery or was it extortion? And the jury decided that it was the state regulator extorting money from the dump founder. The state regulator went to jail, and the dump company went on its merry way. There was literal cash, gold, and precious stones exchanged in the founding of EnviroCare in Utah decades ago.
So the regulator went to jail, but the company that was bribing him or her, they just, no penalty.
No, they went on their merry way and have made a lot of money and became a national radioactive waste dump. But the good people of Utah, groups like Heal Utah and Families Against Incinerator Risks, have blocked Energy Solutions from expanding their dump into higher and hotter categories of radioactive waste. And literally, vertically, they only have a square mile of desert to work with in western Utah. And the company wanted to go up in the air, a radioactive Mount Trashmore. And the good people of Utah, the environmental movement out there, said, nope, you're not going to get away with this.
Let's say somebody in Utah is listening to this show. They do the right thing. They subscribe to Loud and Clear on iTunes or iHeartRadio.
Or Spotify now.
Or Spotify.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, Spotify.
You're supposed to tell me.
Oh, sorry.
Or John, you're supposed to tell us that. But anyway, we're off the beaten track here. Kevin, how is there a list somewhere, like a directory for people who hearing you, let's say, and they're like, wow, this is organized crime. It's dangerous, but there's good people fighting back in Utah. How do people find out about the groups around the country?
So our website, beyondnuclear.org, has, you know, a high-level radioactive waste section, a low-level, so whatever your interest, reactors. Another great group is Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and their website is nirs.org. And so if you explore our websites, you're going to start to meet the groups near you. You can also just contact us, and we'll put you in touch. There are watchdog groups, multiple watchdog groups, on every radioactive waste dump in this country, on essentially every nuclear power plant in this country. The real scary places are where there are not watchdog groups, because folks who've been at it for a half century pass on, and there's not a young generation picking up the torch. That's our constant struggle.
Yeah, I can see that, because the issue of nuclear energy, the dangers posed, that was particularly strong in the late 1970s, early 1980s. That's a long time ago. So yeah, I could see a generational shift there. But here's one thing that kind of perplexes me, and maybe it goes back to the question of mobilization, education, outreach, etc. There's a high degree of consciousness in this country now about the dangers of radiation. Like, if you talk to people about getting x-rays, you know, even dental x-rays, which are very, very low-level x-rays or radiation, a lot of people are concerned, well, I don't know if I want that x-ray. Or if you're your doctor says, well, you need a CAT scan because you were a smoker for 20 years. And people say, I don't know if I want to get that kind of radiation. There's a consciousness about the danger of radiation. And yet we have throughout society, not in the individualized case, but throughout society, all of these radioactive dangers all around us, but not the same kind of consciousness as perhaps existed in 1979 or 1980 or the early 80s.
Well, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is supposed to protect public health and safety, as is the Environmental Protection Agency, and they are often stooges for the industry. They sometimes are to the right of the nuclear power industry on these matters. And so we just survived, more than survived, we did really well at this public comment on environmental scoping regarding the Holtec, Eddie Lee Energy Alliance proposal for centralized interim storage of irradiated nuclear fuel in southeastern New Mexico. Thousands and thousands of public comments were submitted through the good work of groups like Nuclear Issues Study Group in Albuquerque and NIRS here in Washington and Public Citizen here and in Texas, and very quality comments too. And so we're trying to educate people about these risks that have no benefit to the public. You know, these mobile Chernobyls, these floating Fukushimas, these dirty bombs on wheels that would travel by the thousands through most states over 50 years to get out to New Mexico from the nuclear power plants that will give off gamma and neutron as they roll through a town like Tacoma Park, Maryland on the train line as you're standing on the subway platform waiting to catch Metro. And get your little dose of harmful gamma and neutron radiation because these companies need to make their profits and the NRC has decided to compromise on the safety and allow a certain level of routine radiation emissions to come off. And then if the containers are contaminated on the exterior, those harms are much greater. And there's a long history of that here in the U.S. and in France where they've had hundreds of contaminated shipments rolling around through our communities. And then there's the danger of severe accidents or even attacks that would release the contents of these shipping containers. And so there's no benefit to the public from this, but the companies involved are making a killing.
Well, luckily, the whole world loves the U.S., so I'm sure we're not the target of any of that.
There are, unfortunately, 50-year-old, 40-year-old weapon systems like the TOW anti-tank missile that are widely available on the international black market that can blow holes in these shipping containers. These containers were not designed to withstand such an attack. And the government agencies, yet again, are not taking this threat seriously.
Yeah, that was sarcasm for the record, but I hear you.
Can I just ask another question? You just mentioned the easy to blow a hole in. There's all these wildfires that are raging around the country and around the world. I mean, the world is baking right now. I mean, people might say, oh, this happened last year or it happened 30 years ago, whatever. It's baking. The world is baking. The New York Times today has a very dramatic, I don't know if you've seen it, a graphic photo and video story. And it's about how the earth, about climate change was a known thing. The science was in by 1980. And the headline of this story is Losing Earth, the Decade We Almost Stopped Climate Change. And it's kind of a gloomy story in a way. Because it makes it seem as if we're past the point of no return. That's not my point. My point is this. We are experiencing global warming and there are extreme weather events and these raging fires. You talked about the danger posed by sort of missiles or anti-tank missiles that got into the wrong hands, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe all hands are the wrong hands for those. What about so-called natural events, weather events, and the dangers they pose to these kind of nuclear facilities?
No, that's an excellent point. I mean, there's that question, can nuclear power save the climate? The industry would like you to think so because they'd love to get a hold of, you know, hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars of public money to build new reactors to keep their old ones going. The thing is, in a climate destabilized world, nuclear power is too dangerous to operate. So, you know, these monster weather extreme events like mile-wide tornadoes hitting a nuclear plant, that could be pretty bad. I mean, the containment around the reactor might survive, but the wet storage pool probably won't survive. And the thing about it is you lose the cooling water and the waste is so hot that once the cooling water is gone, it's going to catch fire and release its contents onto the air. Rising sea levels, these fires, I mean, there is a shutdown nuclear power plant in Northern California called Humboldt Bay. There's another shutdown one in Sacramento, and one would hope, one would think that the powers that be in California would make sure that those don't go up in flames because they still have their high-level radioactive waste there. That would be unacceptable. That would be time zone ending, like we almost saw in Japan. So yeah, that's the lie of the nuclear power propaganda campaign.
Time zone ending?
Well, you know, turning time zones into dead zones is a phrase. So in Japan, if that pool had gone up in flames, the Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, said it would have been the end of the Japanese state. They would have evacuated 50 million people. Where would they go? Japan's a small country, but the devastation economically and sociologically from that evacuation would have ended the Japanese state. It would have gone from the, what is it, third largest economy on the planet to the bottom economy on the planet overnight.
Well, keeping with discussing some of the reactors that have been closing, we have had some close here in the U.S., but Kevin, we've seen a lot starting to close in Europe as well. Do you want to talk us through kind of how many are shutting down and where those are and what kind of an effect those will have?
Well, you know, we talk a lot of doom and gloom, but the good news is with the reactor shutdowns, you can't have a meltdown anymore, and you've stopped making the high-level radioactive waste. That's all really good news.
Right, that's important.
So Belgium just announced a couple days ago they're going to phase out nuclear power, 7 reactors in that country by the year 2025. Germany, just after Fukushima, said we're going to phase out all 18 or 20 of our reactors by 2022. So this is the trend. And in the United States, we're seeing more and more reactors announced shutdown. That's the good news.
And France as well.
France had a referendum after Fukushima, and the vote by the people of France was to shut down a third of their fleet of nuclear reactors, 58 reactors in that country, which means the one-third shutdown in France is bigger than Germany's shutdown because there are so many reactors in France, and that was through popular demand.
Kevin Camps, Nicole Roussel, we have 90 seconds left. Where do we want to go out?
Do you want to talk about the Alabama nuclear plant and tell us a little bit more about zombie nukes?
Zombie nukes?
Zombie nukes.
Sure, there's a nuclear entrepreneur who's decided for the umpteenth time to try to resurrect a zombie nuke in Alabama called Bellefont, which has been under construction and then canceled and then under construction and canceled time and time again for the past couple decades now.
And pillaged for parts, don't forget.
They even cannibalized the 2 reactors there for parts at other Tennessee Valley Authority reactors, which made sense if the construction was canceled, but now they're trying to bring it back. And guess who gets to pay for those astronomical costs?
Wait a second, big corporations.
Is it big corporations?
No, it's the public.
Politicians.
Oh, it's the ratepayers.
It's ratepayers again?
And maybe taxpayers. But there have been TVA country, there have been zombie actions to stop this looting of the public. So anti-nuke protesters dressed as zombies showing up at TVA headquarters.
I appreciated a tweet you sent over by Scott Stepp of the Hastings Group. You could get 6 or more nuclear plants of capacity in solar from the $13 billion that it will take to bring this Alabama White Elephant project out of mothballs and finish it. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Those are the opportunity costs. Solar PV, photovoltaics, became more cost-effective than new nuclear over a decade ago. Wind power before that. And so the money we waste on nuclear power can't go into renewables.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the Organization Beyond Nuclear. We talk about these issues every Wednesday. The most important thing, again, for our audience is not just that we have a fascinating show and you learn a lot about this issue, but we want people to get involved in this issue. And to do so, you need to go to the website of beyondnuclear.org. That's Kevin Kemp's website. Kevin, again, is the radioactive waste watchdog at that organization, beyondnuclear.org. We're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.